You are listening to a podcast from the Carnegie Endowment for International Peace.
Good morning, ladies and gentlemen. My name is Olga Shumilo-Tapiola, and I'm a visiting scholar at Carnegie. I'm pleased to welcome you at Carnegie Europe this morning. In 2005, one scholar said that Europe will run the 21st century, and basically that the main power of Europe is in its institutions and norms. But then we saw the problems of the last years, and it is very difficult to say that Europe is keeping up with that image that was assigned for it in 2004. The ratification of the Lisbon Treaty gave us hope that things will change and Europe will be stronger. But again, the challenges of the last years showed that it's not materializing yet. The question is, of course, will Europe be able to overcome the challenges of the 21st century? For instance, will the member states will go for a stronger union, or will they opt for abandoning European norms for the sake of overcoming the crisis, the economic crisis? Today, I have a pleasure of presenting you Richard Youngs, who will try to answer these questions. And the one who wrote the book, Europe's Decline and Fall, The Struggle Against Global Irrelevance. Richard is a general director at FRIDE in Madrid, and he is also an assistant professor at Warwick University in the UK. Richard writes extensively on democracy promotion and democratization, on European foreign policy, on energy security and the MENA region. And I think Richard is the best person to talk about Europe's fall and decline and probably give us some hope too. Please, Richard.
Thank you very much, Olga, and to Carnegie for hosting this debate. I'll be very brief, just give a very short overview of the book so we can hear plenty from Peter and Antonio and take questions and discussion from the floor. The basic premise of the book is that obviously the issue of Europe's relative decline is at the forefront of all policy debate at the moment. And the premise is that we need to stop simply noting the fact of Europe's decline. The book doesn't really go into debates over how serious or what the magnitude is of that decline. Rather, it takes a step back and say the decline has been registered. Now we need to start debating in a more systematic fashion how we respond best. So that's really the effort the book makes to try and take the debate forward another step. The book adds to debates by assessing this challenge of relative decline across all the major areas of European foreign policy. So it looks at challenges facing us in terms of multilateral diplomacy, security, human rights and democracy, the issue of European identity in international affairs, as well as the issue of economic policy. So it's making the point that the challenge of decline is not just about the current economic crisis, and it's not just about dealing with a rising China, that are obviously the two issues that attract most attention. The central thesis of the book is to say that in all these primary areas of European foreign policy, we're beginning to see a drift towards less liberal policies on the part of the European Union. I think we're beginning to see policies that are a little bit more introspective, more defensive, arguably a slide into more realist positions in terms of European foreign policy. The argument the book makes is that to some extent this is justified. In a post-Western world, we do need a slightly more hard-headed and cautious realpolitik. We need to drop some of the liberal hubris of the 1990s. But there is a danger of this drift going a little bit too far. And I make the argument that to navigate this post-Western world, a more multipolar world, effective responses require Europe to be more outward-looking, more internationalist, more cosmopolitan, not less. In that sense, I realize the book is a little bit counterintuitive, probably goes in the opposite direction from a lot of the analysis and policy advice being touted at the moment. Obviously, I don't have time to go into all the details of the different policy areas that the book looks at. Olga suggested I just choose one to give you an example. So if we take the example of human rights and democracy, the issue of universal political values, I think it's fairly generally agreed now that the EU's commitment to supporting democracy and human rights internationally has weakened slightly in recent years. I realize many of the people here working on this will insist that the EU still is a kind of one of the last bastions of support for universal political values. I think, however, if you scratch beneath the surface, the EU's record on these issues of human rights and support for democratic reform around the world is less strong than it could have been in recent years. And the book charts how this is the case both in Europe's immediate neighborhood and further afield. So I think today the EU's virtually given up on political conditionality, and we see decreasing pressure for democratic reforms in different parts of the world. The political dialogues that the EU has initiated have been rather tepid, and the money, the development funding that the EU spends on human rights and democracy is still very, very limited, and the types of projects that the EU funds are very soft and cautious indeed. So I think in all this, we see a certain crisis of the human rights and democracy agenda. One picks up a feeling that Europe today simply can't make much of an impact on political trends in different parts of the world, and that in a way, attempts to do so may even lack legitimacy today. The book points out, however, that just as the EU stepped back from supporting democratic reform and human rights, the evidence suggests that people living in non-democratic regimes around the world, if anything, want greater support from Europe, not less support. So I just give just one example of one kind of policy area where I think we can see this incipient shift in the nature of European foreign policy. Just to take a step back and offer four overarching trends or conclusions that I think emerge from the different policy areas that may help shape our debate. Just four very brief observations. Number one, I think the danger is that there is increasingly too much of a shift towards a kind of realist, defensive, zero-sum, spheres of influence type thinking in our strategic policies. As I said, I think some of the shift in this direction is justified, but I think we must be careful not to see the emerging world order and the rise of other powers purely in zero-sum terms. I think if the changing balance of power in the world is correctly managed, this shift should be positive sum. It should open up new markets, bring other powers to the table to help share the burden of solving international issues. And of course, the problem with zero-sum thinking is that the more one sees and approaches the world in zero-sum terms, the more likely that is that that will be the outcome. It risks being a self-fulfilling approach. And I think one is not really sure that dropping the concern with human rights and democracy is something that is really in tune with the times. So the book makes the argument that dealing with the post-Western world is not only a question of ingratiating state-to-state relations with emerging powers, it's also about trying to read emerging, empowering social trends. I mean, the new world order, the multipolar world order, is very complex. It is about more than simply the rise of the BRICS. And I think there is a danger of slightly losing sight of this complexity in terms of what the shape of the new world order will look like. So that's the first conclusion. Second would be the EU's fixation with its own institutions. Again, I appreciate many here will probably disagree with this observation. This is not to say that the changes of the Lisbon Treaty are not positive or important. I believe they are. And it was inevitable that some time would be needed to deal with the fine-tuning of these new institutions. But I do feel that the political capital invested in getting the External Action Service up and running has been rather disproportionate, and has been a distraction from some of the kind of big substantive debates we really need to have about Europe's place in the changing world order. In fact, one picks up this lament from many diplomats in Brussels and national capitals. I think the danger here is that this reflects still a mindset on the part of the EU that the most important challenge is to get the institutions right. If only we can get the institutions right, everything else will fall into place. And I make the argument in the book that in a way, we must give equal importance to addressing the kind of substantive drift in European policies. This is, of course, relevant to the future, that it seems that this mentality of getting the institutions right always leads into another round of institutional fine-tuning. The temptation is always to think if only we can perfect the reforms in the next round of treaty changes, then things will be okay, and that there's a slight danger there that this becomes a little bit of an eternal process that constantly diverts us from the big substantive debates. So that's the second overarching thought. Third is that I think in some senses, some of the most traditional standard critiques of European foreign policy, in a way, are 180 degrees wrong. What do I mean by this? I mean that perhaps the most common argument the one hears is that the EU is simply too nice, too liberal, too normative, too ethical for its own good, and that in a post-Western world order, we need to get real. We need to have a far harder-edged approach to power. Again, I think that this is a slight misdiagnosis. I think, at least in some areas, the problem is quite the opposite, that the EU's already become a little bit too self-referential, too self-centered, too inward-looking, too short-termist in the way that it defines its own interests, and possibly not enlightened or cosmopolitan enough in looking to the longer term. So that I think the danger here is that if we misdiagnose the EU's condition, the policy advice that follows from that risks being very mistaken. Fourth and final concluding thought is that I'm sure many of us here would feel that traditionally the strongest source of Europe's international influence has been its own model, its own rules, the effort to export the EU's own regulations and processes and standards. To some extent, this has certainly been the case, but I think there's also a danger that increasingly this approach looks a little bit too heavy and too uniform. I think in many places, even on the EU's immediate periphery, this approach of exporting the EU's own administrative rules is struggling to gain traction. This approach, it seems to me, still works on the basis of seeing the EU at the center of a ring of concentric circles of decreasing Europeanization going outwards from the European Union. And one just wonders that in a post-Western world order, whether we don't need a slightly different way mentally of seeing the structure of international politics. So I think those are my kind of four overarching thoughts that I put on the table for debate, and perhaps leave it there for Antonio and Peter.
Thank you, Richard. I will pass the floor to Antonio Missiroli, who is the head of the European Dialogue Section at the Bureau of European Policy Advisors at the European Commission, who will be the first commentator, please.
Thank you, Olga. Of course, I'm speaking in a personal capacity. I'm not speaking on behalf of the President of the Commission here. And I have to say that I enjoyed the book very much. It is extremely well written. And if I may paraphrase Mark Twain, it's not as bad as it sounds. I mean, Europe's Decline and Fall, in particular, is a sort of overdramatic title that doesn't correspond to the actual contents of the book. My first impression is that it was probably completed and closed in the late spring, and all the events that have followed only confirmed, to a certain extent, the kind of perception that the book conveys. And to a certain extent, paradoxically, it also, the developments that have followed also put the main topic of the book in a different context. I mean, does foreign policy matter
at this stage.
I mean, I'm a foreign policy wonk like Richard, but I have the impression that the future of Europe, its possible decline or even fall, will not depend on foreign policy in the first place. It will depend on the kind of reforms that we are capable of enforcing on the Eurozone structure and on modernizing our economies. That is going to be the bread and butter of European integration internally, but also the ability of the European Union to project itself onto the world stage. The emerging powers are emerging also politically because they have emerged economically. And for Europe, the big challenge is precisely to live up to the challenges of the 21st century in this respect. Foreign policy in this context is a sort of jam on the bread and butter. It is something that could make Europe's position in the world more palatable, could be a good sweetener, but it's not the substance of what is going to happen. And I think we have to have this sort of sobering thought in mind when we discuss all these things. To a certain extent, even, one of the paradoxes of the current situation, apart from the wrangling over institutions and procedures, is that the kind of reforms that every member state is willing to accept at this stage, more or less, with nuances, are more likely to curtail and restrain national sovereignty than any treaty change that is conceivable at this stage. And this is not emerging sufficiently clearly in the current discussion. Whereas everybody insists on preserving national sovereignty, well, the kind of limitation to national sovereignty that is about to be adopted perhaps this week in terms of economic governance and fiscal policy is amazing, and nobody is talking about this, but it is one of the paradoxes of the current situation. But if and insofar foreign policy matters, my main impression from the book is that much as a foreign policy wonk, I liked the main argument, it is the kind of book that may sound a little bit irritating to practitioners because it is full of sweeping statements and charges that are not sufficiently corroborated with evidence, hard evidence, cases, examples. And it's certainly true that intuitively we all agree with the kind of photography and diagnosis that Richard makes in his book. But when it comes to the details, to the specific cases, I think that we have to be more precise in allocating responsibility and also in trying to highlight the possible remedies. For instance, I think in this room at least, we broadly agree on the fact that human rights and democracy should be one of the driving elements of European foreign policy. But if we agree on the goals, do we also agree on the means to bring that about? When it comes to implementation, it is not a one-size-fits-all approach that we have to adopt. When it comes to Egypt or Iran, when it comes to China or Burma, I mean, the policy approaches are very different. We probably don't agree, also internally, on how best to deal with all these issues. And, of course, it makes a big difference. And one thing, is the rhetoric that is more or less in line with Richard's assumption. And the other thing is the implementation. Both at the EU level, very often there is impotence of lack of action precisely because there is no agreement among the member states. But sometimes also the conduct of some member states or some companies in the member state is not entirely in line with the values that we proclaim in that particular domain. But even if we stick to human rights and democracy as the driving force, and this is my last point in order to leave room for the discussion, we have to be aware that is not the whole story. There has been a lot of discussion over the basics, over the BRICS, over the emerging powers. What about the bit? I mean, three of the most important emerging powers today are Brazil, India, and Turkey. These are democracies. These are among the most populous democracies in the world. So that is not the main point. But the main point is that these countries do not acknowledge the setup of the international system as it is, precisely because it has been forged by the Western powers, the old Western powers, and they do not recognize it. And therefore, it's not just about human rights and democracy. It's also about envisaging a different setup of the international system that can give adequate role to these powers in ways that probably are likely to affect the role of the European Union. Last point on decline. Richard himself qualifies the notion of decline. He talks of relative decline. And I think that relative decline can be managed sufficiently well, especially if you know what the problems are like. Let's not forget that Harold Macmillan became British Prime Minister in the 1950s after Suez, that is, after the most striking evidence of the decline of British power in the world, and still in the ensuing electoral campaign to his citizens, he proclaimed, "You never had it so good." So there still is hope for Europeans in this particular respect, and as rational policymakers and analysts, we have to be aware that if we know what the problem is like, it is also more likely to be addressed properly.
Thank you, Antonio. I think without further ado, I will pass the floor to Peter Spiegel, who is the chief of Brussels Bureau of the Financial Times. Please, Peter.
Thank you, Olga. This actually works out well. I was told to be critical and provocative. Antonio has been critical on the positive side. I will be critical on the negative side. Let me just first off say, as well that I really enjoyed the book. I agree wholeheartedly with its overall diagnosis of the problem. I see it sort of as a cri de coeur about, hey, wake up, Europe. We need to be more relevant. And I think that is a very timely message, because as someone who comes to Brussels from Washington but spent quite a bit of time in conflict areas of the Middle East and Central Asia and South Asia, Europe's role in the world is declining, and it has become less relevant in many of these debates than it probably should be. Where I will disagree is on some of the prescriptions. I have organized my thoughts a little bit differently than your four trends, but I'll try to mesh the two. I wouldn't say I disagree completely on the prescriptions, because I think you have the ideas about what Europe should stop doing are exactly spot on. The problem I have is what then positively should Europe be doing? Because I am more pessimistic about whether Europe can reform itself, can be more outlooking in the world. The first thing I have down here is this obsession with internal processes. And again, I've only been here 3 months, but I am struck by the extent to which that has obsessed the debate here, particularly post-Lisbon, the need to focus on setting up the Internal Action Service. I think you are rather upset with the criticism of Ashton. I must say that for an institution that is new, having someone in that position who is unknown to the outside world was a big problem. Javier Solana was paid attention to because he was Javier Solana, not because he was part of his institution. He was known as former Secretary General of NATO. He had international respect to going into that job. As part of that, you talk about this obsession with the Kissinger, I can pick up the phone and I can't call Europe. It's interesting you point that out, and I think you sort of argue that maybe we don't need a single voice. It is not such a bad thing to have multiple voices, and I have to agree with that, because I do not believe it is possible to have a single voice in Europe. Antonio talked about the need to cite examples. The thing that always comes to my mind is Europe's most important, I would say, local relationship, and that's with Russia. A couple of examples. France is selling an amphibious assault ship, the Mistral, to the Russians, over strong objections, certainly by Georgia, which obviously is not an EU member, but an aspirant both to the EU and NATO, but also over objections from Eastern Europe. How is that able to be rectified in a single voice in Europe? I don't think it will be. Again, energy security with Russia. You have the Germans, obviously, the deal with Gazprom over Nord Stream. You have Gerhard Schroeder going to join Gazprom after that. Clearly angering and at the national security detriment to the Baltic states and to Eastern Europe. How is that anything that can be resolved by one voice? So I am pessimistic that single voice can be created. The issue that you raise, again, I'm trying to bring this together, this danger of too much shift to realpolitik, to the idea of realism. Again, I couldn't agree more. I think that is happening not only in Europe, but also in the United States, where you have the Democratic Party, which is in some ways an extension of, I think, European foreign policy. They talk to each other, communicate each other quite frequently. Both the traditional places where human rights, democracy promotion, that used to be quote-unquote liberal values or promoted by the left, for lack of a better word. The Bush administration, frankly, I think has poisoned that for everyone. For some reason, because of Iraq, and because of the rhetoric of democracy promotion in the Middle East, it has become poisonous for the political left or the European elites to discuss democracy promotion. And I agree. If Europe has, and the United States, frankly, if it is no longer going to rely on hard power, if it has one area where it can serve as an example for the rest of the world, it is in those values promotion that it needs to reassert. Again, examples. We had a summit here with the Chinese. The extent to which human rights came up was almost non-existent. David Cameron traveled to Beijing relatively recently. It was a mercantilist trade promotion trip, no mention of human rights. The French, after Sarkozy taking a very strong position on the Dalai Lama, almost did not go to the Nobel Peace Prize ceremony at the pressure of the Chinese. The extent to which human rights and democracy promotion has disappeared from the debate here in Europe, I am struck by. And that flows into this issue of the EU being perhaps too nice, which I agree with. I think there is a role for hard power, which gets me to the next, I guess, pessimistic thing I want to touch on, is this issue you raise of unity for unity's sake. Is a solution to everything Europeanizing the policy. And I guess if we look at historical examples, there are certain issues and topics that are easily internationalized. Trade, economic governance, corporate regulation. There are certain competencies that lend themselves to international organizations or multilateral cooperation. Does foreign policy really lend itself to that? And I think we have examples of military alliances that do, obviously NATO being the preeminent example of that. But those are always rather hard power alliances. They are protection against an outside threat. Is it possible for 27 nation states to have a single voice, a single interest in foreign policy? I am skeptical. You address the issue of the EU trying to replicate itself elsewhere. I couldn't agree with that more. This is the area I think that is where you are most effective in your argument. This issue of instead of trying to replicate the model and seeing Europe as a series of concentric circles, identifying European interests and then deciding how to influence them. I find that to be a very attractive way of rethinking the way Europe goes about conducting foreign policy. I will end there because I think I've touched on your four themes. But I just want to close with one last point, which is what I think is the need to rethink the role of the nation state. I know the European project has been a project away from that. But having spent time in the Middle East and in South Asia, you constantly run into instances where particularly France and particularly Britain punch way above their weights because of, let's be honest, the history of the colonialism. In India, in Pakistan, what the British Foreign Secretary says matters. In Iraq, what Britain says matters. In the Levant, what France says matters. And in Francophone Africa, what France says matters. Spain, Latin America, these former spheres of influence that occurred in the 19th century. Are there ways to use that existing influence in those regions and capitalize on them as ways to reinvigorate the European role in foreign policy? As Antonio said, the current trend seems to be attempting to denude or restrain national sovereignty in almost every role. And in certain areas, particularly in the Eurozone and the economic crisis, that makes a lot of sense. I'm not sure that makes a whole lot of sense when Europe already has significant influence in the world, but from the nation state, how can that be harnessed to make Europe more influential internationally? And I think that is the real challenge.
Thank you, Peter. I will open the floor for comments, questions, and answers. Please present yourself.
Thank you.
We'll take three questions and then...
Thank you. Wang Yiwei from Fudan University, Shanghai. I arrived a little bit late, so I just listened to you mention about the multipolar world and the post-Western world. Is that same thing? What's the post-Western world? It's a post-European world, post-American world. It seems like the European decline compared to the American decline is not the same case. You know, in the IMF, the World Bank, I think U.S. still kept the rate, kept the quote, on the costs of the European and the Japanese in the declining. What's the meaning of the post-Western world? It's not just the multipolar world. I think it's a diverse world. And more means the world is more diverse. It's not just a power structure, it's an institution. Basically, it's ideology. That with the rise of the silent majority, that Europeans cannot represent universal values anymore. Because as a demography or, you know, as you said, also a different approach to reach human rights and democracy. Yes, human rights, democracy, maybe. It's a universal values, but it's how to achieve these universal values. The different nations, especially different civilizations, they have the different way. All the roads go to Rome. So a European approach, especially the European Union approach, is just one of them. So in this regard, I think it's irrelevant. So because the world awakened, like the WikiLeaks, you know, it's not just a nation rights. It's also, you know, decentralization of the world. And my second comment is about what's the reason of the, you said, declining or irrelevance of the European Union or Europe? It's not the same case. Sometimes I said European Union is still a rising power, but unfortunately on the declining continent. So maybe it's more complex to say that. I mean, what the reason? Is because of the European civilization, is it because of the Western democracy, or because of identification of the European Union? For example, you identify yourself as a normative power. It seems like the world isn't lived in the nation state, in a realist world. It's not the normative context, especially in Asia. What happened since this summer? The American military excesses, again and again, you say the flexing muscles, offensive drilling, but no any comments, no any, you know, from the European Union as a peace power. I don't think you can do something to stop this, you know, power gains, you know, in Asia. So is it because of identification problem, or you are the lonely normative power, the American lonely superpower? I think that's the question.
Thank you.
Thank you. My name is Kun Lim. I work for the European Commission, but I'd like to speak on my personal behalf here. Now, Mr. Young, I have a question for you, a provocative one, if I may, but since it's so early in the morning. Mr. Young, would you advise that the UK get out of the European Union so Europe can express better its world through the European Union in the matter that relates to global matters such as international peace and so on? If you look, for example, into the Strategic Defense and Security Review, if you look into the French-UK bilateral agreement of early November, and if you look in that light, the websites of the number 10, for example, which express that in quite a different tone than when you look into the French opinion about that same bilateral agreement, then you get a kind of a feeling that if you want to construct Europeans or the European Union's position in this global matter, then we certainly need a kind of a consensus. And ideally, that consensus should not be the smallest common denominator. So where do we stand? If I can have your opinion on that. Thank you.
Ida?
Thank you. I'm Pirkko Tapiola, and I work for something undefined, which in a few weeks supposedly is to be the External Action Service. So it's going to be out there. Now, I was a bit surprised, or maybe not, over what Richard said about giving up on conditionality and regarding human rights and democracy, because of course the point which was made regarding the Bush administration is a valid one. We've had discussions on what is Europe's sort of, I hate to use the word democracy promotion agenda, but what is our agenda in working on these issues? And it is true that we have moved away from declaratory policies maybe and sort of beating countries up to engagement and trying to nudge processes forward. And frankly, if we look at success with countries like Belarus and Burma and others, where when we didn't engage, when we were more sort of isolationist, that success hasn't been that great. So I would like to hear from you a bit more sort of examples on where we have done this, because in fact, I think there's a growing understanding that by engaging, by building incentives, by sort of trying to build common ground, we might get better functioning societies and we may, in fact, be able to promote that agenda. Very closely tied to this, I was a bit also surprised on what you said about exporting the EU's own administrative rules and on spheres of influence, because this is, of course, sort of all tied to each together, and I've been especially working with the neighborhood. Now, we've very carefully avoided zero-sum thinking, and we continue to do that, with precisely the idea in mind that we would not be exporting or forcing our sort of systems on countries, but rather, if we look at, for instance, the Eastern neighborhood, these countries have openly announced that this is what they want. that they would, they've talked about European integration, we've talked about political association and economic integration in the sort of Eastern Partnership context, et cetera, et cetera. But rather than sort of say, even if we've said in the European Security Strategy that, okay, we want a ring, we would like to foster a ring of well-governed countries around us. So still, we have not tried to impose, but rather put out offers there where these countries can take what they have publicly announced that they would want. So I would challenge you a little bit on the spheres of influence thinking here as well. Thanks.
I think we'll go just with the answer now and then another set of questions. Yes.
Okay, we're just being very selective. I suppose relative to my fellow panelists, I find myself a little bit in the middle, perhaps a slightly more frustrated than Antonio, perhaps still with a slightly greater strand of optimism than Peter, but perhaps misplaced. I think Antonio made a very good point that given the magnitude of the economic crisis and the imperative of economic reform, is foreign policy really so important today? I think that's a well-made point, except perhaps that the EU's economic health and the fortunes of its economic reforms, of course, do depend on what's going on in international markets, and the EU's commercial reach depends on political trends in those markets. So I think I think the point is well registered, but one perhaps needs to be a little bit careful about thinking that one can completely separate off the nature of internal economic reforms from the broader strategic and political elements of our foreign policies. The recurrent issue on democracy and human rights, I take the point that it isn't about simply repeating the general rhetorical commitment. The issue is to find effective means of assisting reform. The book was not meant to say that we should be imposing democratic sanctions on grounds of democratic shortfalls everywhere in the world. Your picker is absolutely right that in most cases, this kind of tactic of ostracization has not proved effective. What the book does is say, yes, we need engagement, but once the EU succeeds in building up this very dense network of engagement that it is very good at doing, it's then a question of how it gains political leverage from that very dense degree of engagement when reform opportunities do present themselves. And that's the aspect that I find disappointing. Of course, we sit here in a week where the Egyptian regime has succeeded in basically ejecting any opposition representatives from the parliament. And yet at the same time, the EU still has on the table the prospect of an upgraded, enhanced agreement with Egypt. Of course, we will see whether that is followed through. So I think worrying and disappointing fact is we've had almost two decades now of doing exactly what Antonio suggested, debating what is the effective means of supporting human rights. How do you mix pressure and engagement? How do you best spend the resources that you dedicate to human rights and democracy projects on the ground? And none of the different approaches seem to have worked, and this seems to be breeding a little bit of frustration on just what we do in terms of fashioning a more effective strategy for human rights and democracy. And in a way, that relates to Picker's point also about this change of approach and not the EU not enforcing its own rules, but perhaps switching more to a kind of positive conditionality approach, that if partner countries do want to sign up to areas of cooperation with the EU, then that paves the way to deeper integration. The fear I register in the book is that it may be that some countries are increasingly looking at what's on offer, concluding that this looks a little bit heavy in terms of the state and administrative capacity they need to incorporate all these rules and regulations, and perhaps looking for different kinds of partnerships elsewhere. And I think that's just something the EU needs to be a little bit careful of. Turning to Peter's suggestions, when I basically support his comments about us being careful not seeing unity for unity's sake. And I mean, the points were not really meant as kind of Eurosceptic points to say that it isn't important to support greater European coordination, but rather just to say that these kind of institutional changes, having a single voice, isn't a panacea. It isn't a solution in itself. Because of the divergence over the big substantive question, one wonders whether we're just using the institutional issue sometimes as a pretext for not getting to grips with these big substantive issues. I think you hone in on absolutely crucial issue is that the EU needs to be better at thinking in geostrategic terms, identifying what its interests are, and then dovetailing its instruments to those interests, not vice versa. And of course, I think the big issue here will be the strategic partnerships over the next year, which I personally think is a potentially very good instrument. What the EU needs to do now is to start filling these strategic partnerships with some substance and agree who really is a strategic partner and who is not. Finally, on the UK, I wouldn't recommend throwing the UK out of the EU. I think on most of the issues, the foreign policy issues the book looks at, I'm not sure it's the UK that is most responsible for blocking progress. UK is part of it, but it's a general mindset that I think pervades thinking on the part of a number of member states. So I think if the UK were to leave, that wouldn't unblock progress and all these kind of issues that I talk about in the book.
Would you like to have some comments, Peter?
Yeah, I just want to address a couple of the questions from the audience. First, from the gentleman from Fudan University. On the issue of universal values and the divergence being on how to get there versus the values themselves, it's a very interesting point. I spent, shortly after the Mumbai attacks, I spent about a month in India and then spent a month in China. And the thing that struck me about spending time in both those places is India has embraced Western values, democracy, human rights, and yet it is a poor, corrupt society that is growing quickly, but largely for a small percentage of the population. You go to Beijing, you do not have what we normally refer to as democracy and human rights, and yet over the last 10 years, 200 million people were pulled out of poverty and now are not starving. What do we define as human rights? Is that not a human right to be able to survive without worrying about where you can get your next meal? It was a discussion you would constantly engage with by the Chinese while you were there. It got me thinking quite a bit, and I think it does behoove us to think a little bit more what we mean by universal values and universal rights. The other point you make about hard power versus soft power, you can tell from my accent, I probably am more prone to support the hard power argument. I also spent 8 years covering the military, so I do have certain biases in this regard. But I do genuinely believe when you look at the ability of international actors to have influence on the world stage, that hard military power is preeminent. It is still why the British and the French are the most effective Europeans internationally. They are the two European countries that have deployable militaries. It gives them influence in places where they otherwise would not. I do believe that has to be thought about when you think about a European power in the world. I have the same exact thought on the UK out of the EU. I do not actually believe that if we put Iraq aside, and everything is sort of seems to be colored by the debate on Iraq in Europe, that UK is not alone in having its own thoughts on foreign policy. The French, in particular, have their own thoughts. I still see the divide much more as West versus East. That the emerging new members of the East have much different geostrategic interests than the old members of the West, and I think that is much more the divergence. On the issue of systems exportation, I must say I think that there is probably no greater foreign policy achievement than Europe's expansion over the last 20 years. I mean, look at what has happened to Eastern Europe. Even countries that are not yet members, Turkey, the change that we've seen in Turkey over the last 20 years is explicitly thanks to the aspiration of Turkish membership. So I don't want to belittle that effort, and frankly, I think it needs to be reinvigorated. But I think that success, in some cases, has blinded the policymakers to thinking that that is the only way that Europe can have an influence internationally. And I think that's a bit of a danger. You know, there was a phrase that was said to me, I know it's a bit of a been said repeatedly, was said to me most recently by the president of Estonia, who said, big powers do what they can, do what they want to do. Small powers try to create rules and have everyone abide by them. I think that there is an international structure of rules now that it is in the interest of Europe to see everyone abide by. But as several observers have noted, the BRICS, since they were not included, except for China, in a lot of the post-war institutions as leaders, I'm thinking particularly about the UN, are not willing to participate in those structures. And I think for that reason, we have to start rethinking the rules that govern international affairs in order to welcome countries like Brazil and India and Russia into those structures.
Antonio?
I think that the implication of what Ivan said earlier on about Europe, the EU being a rising power and the Europeans being in decline, is perhaps that there are too many Europeans around in international bodies, and perhaps many people in Brussels think there is too little EU. But that is a formula that doesn't tell the whole story yet again. I mean, it is certainly true that Europeans are overrepresented in multilateral bodies and international bodies today, be it the UN Security Council, the IMF itself, the G20 as it is right now. At the same time, it is certainly true that the EU as such doesn't appear as a fully fledged player in most areas. There are areas in which we already act as EU and we should continue acting as EU. Trade is a case in point. I think when it comes to international negotiations over climate change and environment, as in Cancun, there still is a good case for acting as EU. And I personally think, for what it is worth, that when it comes to managing migrations and issues of mobility of people, be it asylum, immigration proper, or issues related to that, it is very difficult to act as a national state in Europe due to the overall setup that we have in this particular respect, although the reluctance to act as EU still exists because interior ministries are not exactly the prototype of internationalists in this particular respect. There is also a case for retaining a degree of minilateralism, if I may put it this way, and not multilateralism in some areas, because the EU perhaps is not yet ripe or there is no sufficient legitimacy for the EU to act as such in some areas. But let me give you three examples, because I think that examples help understanding things. Examples of events that have occurred between September and October of this year. So the Lisbon Treaty was already in place. There was the first, and so far I would say main, foreign policy success by Cathy Ashton. That is the fact that in the General Assembly of the United Nations in September, Serbia accepted to withdraw a draft resolution that was highly critical of the recognition of independence of Kosovo and accepted instead to table a resolution that was negotiated with Cathy Ashton and the EU that opened the door for talks between Pristina and Belgrade. That has been a remarkable success in this particular respect, and it is due to the fact that conditionality and the attractiveness of the EU still play a role for those countries that still want to join the European Union. So that is the old model with all the aspects related to that has worked quite well. There has been a negative case that has been the reform of the IMF. I mean, in that particular case, and despite the letter and the spirit of the Lisbon Treaty that says that the international representation of the euro should be streamlined, there has very little has happened, and we were put shoulders to the wall by very clever tactical conduct by the United States, and in the end, we reluctantly agree in principle on reducing the shares and the seats of Europeans, but we still have to agree among ourselves about exactly how to do about that. That is the negative side, where the interest of the member states still affect negatively the way in which the European Union projects itself externally. And the third case is one in which it has been the outside world that hasn't allowed the European Union to act as such. And it is yet again the General Assembly and the draft resolution that, on the inspiration and pressure of the Belgian presidency, was tabled in September in order to give enhanced status to the EU in the General Assembly, that basically was postponed, but it has been seen widely as a failure of the European Union. Perhaps it was ill-prepared, it was hurried as a resolution. The story is not yet finished. There may be a second go. But in that particular case, it was the rest of the world that didn't accept that the EU as such would act and be a player in the United Nations. So it is an extremely complex picture in which the European Union still has residual
capabilities and assets to put at the service of its international presence. There are cases in which we are ourselves responsible for our ineffectiveness, the IMF being a case in point, and there are cases in which it is the international community that is not exactly conducive to having more Europe and more EU and less Europeans on the international stage.
Thank you, Antonio. The second round of questions, please. Yes.
Liz Scurfield from the Quaker Council for European Affairs. On a positive note, France did go to the Nobel Peace Prize ceremony. Serbia, who said she wasn't going, did go to the Nobel Peace Prize ceremony. I think that's the first thing. The second thing, I do think the EU has to back up its own statements. For instance, on the Middle East, how many statements has, in fact, Cathy Ashton made about the Middle East and the stopping the building of settlements? That has to be followed up, otherwise EU is seen as being without teeth. And I think thirdly, to our friend over there about military intervention, you surely know about Quakers and pacifism. I would say what the EU should be doing is putting a lot more effort into long-term crisis prevention and conflict prevention than in building up its military resources. And thirdly, please watch live stream Cathy Ashton in the Parliament tomorrow. You will see she will be given, I hope, because of work from NGOs, a very hard time on human rights and democracy in the External Action Service.
Thank you. Questions or comments? Well, if briefly, yes, please.
Okay, thank you. To be frankly, not to identify me as nationalist or Chinese nationalism is not simple to say. If you cannot communicate with me, how can you communicate with 1.3 billion people? I'm more liberal, more, you know, open-minded. So about the human rights, about the Nobel Peace Prize, to be frankly, the most Chinese people think it's nothing related to the Chinese human rights with awarded the Liu Xiaobo case. If you really consider about the Chinese human rights, you should avoid somebody like, I raised this question about why not avoid like Deng Xiaoping or somebody, you know, from Lianjiang, you know, now mainland and the Taiwan relations, you know, greatly improved. This is a farewell to the war or conflicts. This is to be deserved to be the human rights, peace rights. Peace is not strongly linked with the democracy or human rights, as I said. This is, I think, betrayed the Nobel's the wishes of the leaders. So it's the most of the Chinese people think this is the naive Europeans that, you know, want to make a joke with Chinese government. You compare with China and India, I don't think it's unfair because they're two great civilizations. Most Chinese people think that the Europeans like India because India fully colonized by you. Nothing related with democracy and human rights, to be frankly. And India still kept the caste system. You know, it's not equal to everybody. I think China, I think in this regard, the good governance, accounting government, with the purse control, with the climate change, whatever, you know, I think China runs. I doubt not to want to compare China and India, but it's more complex. Thank you.
Thank you for your comment. Would we have more questions or comments? If not, then I would suggest that probably we will try to answer the questions or react to comments and wrap up, and we'll start with Peter, Antonio, and then Richard, please. You.
I'm not sure I have too much to add on the second round. Perhaps on the issue on China, just to go a little bit beyond the human rights issue. I think for me, the shortcoming so far in European policy towards China is that it's been very commercially driven. I think increasingly we need to supplement the focus on the commercial relationship with a bit more kind of strategic thinking about how, where the Europe and China can work together on more political and strategic issues, and maybe that would kind of foster the broader engagement that would enable us to talk more on these values-based issues. And, on this question of diversity in human rights standards and models of democracy, of course, the difficulty is to try and distinguish between countries that are genuinely making progress towards different kinds of models of rights and those countries that are using that discourse as a pretext to cover up the fact that, if anything, they're becoming more authoritarian. So I think the EU needs to have the flexibility to deal with different forms of models, but it shouldn't be so naive that it should always take those claims at face value. And you need a very nuanced and sophisticated reading of political developments on the ground in each country to be able to distinguish between those, the genuine and the disingenuous claims in that sense. On Serbia, I agree with Antonia that this was, I think, an example of very skillful EU diplomacy and a definite step forward. Of course, I think to consolidate that gain in the Balkans, the EU does need now to make some progress on accession so that it becomes more of a tangible carrot for Balkan states, not merely a distant aspiration. And of course, we still have the problem of the five states who, even after Serbia's slightly more moderate line, are still adhering to a rather different position on Kosovo. And as someone who sits and works in Madrid, one can appreciate how difficult that is going to be to fashion a really unified position amongst the EU states on Kosovo. On Israel and the peace process, I think now the EU has a really tough decision to make. I think we all realize that the peace process at the moment looks pretty moribund. And of course, the EU now needs to make the decision of whether what it does in terms of the millions, hundreds of millions of euros it's pumping into the Palestinian territories year after year, whether it's that's helping the peace process or not. I think it's a very difficult strategic judgment the EU needs to make over the next few months.
Just also engage on not the Gaza point, but the long-term crisis prevention point you raised. I would add one other thing to this: the importance of capacity building for ungoverned or weakly governed spaces, particularly in the Middle East and Africa. That is an area where Europe could really play an important role. Again, not necessarily exporting rules, but one of the biggest threats that Europe is facing, and frankly all Western interests are facing, is the ability of some of these transnational groups to find places in the world where they can hide and plot. Europe has the capability and the resources to help teach, for lack of a bit of a loaded word, but to build capacity in some of these countries so they can govern themselves. And I think that is an important role for Europe to play. One last one on the Nobel Peace Prize. I will just say that the best response to some of the Chinese sensitivities on this came from an American think tank expert who I've heard, who said, "Welcome to being a superpower." Criticism from the Nobel Peace Committee, Nobel Peace Prize Committee on foreign policy is something that has been Americans have been used to for decades now, so the Chinese should now become used to that as well. So welcome to the top tier.
Thank you, Peter Antonio.
Just two quick remarks. The first one is relative decline as a silver lining that we very often neglect is that millions or billions of people are getting out of poverty and underdevelopment. I mean, this is what is evident in all figures coming from the UN. Poverty is on the decline at the global level, and many, many countries are experiencing a level of growth that some European countries experienced in the 50s. Economists like to say that whereas Europe and to a certain extent the United States are basically substitution markets in which we give back our old car and buy a new one, we give back our old fridge and buy a new one. In most areas of the developing world, it is a new market in which new consumers are entering the market to buy their first fridge and their first car. And this is something that should be welcome worldwide, also as a success to a certain extent, and not just as a reason to be sad and worried about the Titanic scenario for the European Union or the West at large. So we have also to be pleased about relative decline. It is also good news for the world in this particular respect, but it is relative decline that has to be managed. The second point is about the general issue
about the way in which Europe operates or should operate. And I think that we are experiencing ever more the core contradiction that the European Union is all about. That is, on the one hand, the policy arenas and the policy spheres in which we operate are increasingly not simply continental but global. We have to operate policy-wise at a global level, but the political arenas in which consensus is built are still predominantly national. The legitimacy is still predominantly national or even subnational in some cases. And this creates a core contradiction in the way in which we shape policy, in the way in which we take decisions, that is very difficult to surmount, especially at the time of declining resources for public policy, when there are fewer resources for acting at the national level, and therefore the importance of symbolic successes by national leaders is ever more important. And that is what we are living with even when it comes to decisions over the Eurozone. The fact that France will chair jointly the G8 and the G20 next year is going to put all these things to a test, because France will be confronted with the core dilemma. President Sarkozy will have to decide how far he wants to play the national game, because that will basically coincide with his campaign for re-election in France. The first round of presidential elections will be in March 2012. But also to what extent he wants to strengthen the hand of Europe and also to preserve, to a certain extent, certain tenets of the international system that are so dear to Europeans. It's a typical dilemma that hits at the core of the contradiction that I just illustrated. Perhaps the decision that we are about to take about the Eurozone and Monetary Union, EMU 2.0, as some people start calling it, are going to shape also the way in which we operate internationally in this particular respect.
Thank you, Antonio. On behalf of Carnegie Europe, I would like to thank Richard Youngs for bringing the book to Brussels and to Carnegie, and for hitting the debate in Brussels a bit on substance rather than focusing on institutions and other issues. And thank you for Peter Spiegel and Antonio Missiroli for their wonderful, challenging comments to Richard's book, but also for the debate, and for all of you for coming here. We wish you good luck with the book and with shaping the debate in Brussels and other member states' capitals further. Thank you.